This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Nu är gräset ännu grönare. Teckna företagsabonnemang hos Telia och få en Galaxy S9 på köpet. Eller en av våra andra utvalda modeller. Läs mer på telia.se/företag. Fler anledningar? Bäst mobilnät enligt P3s mätning. Sveriges nöjdaste företagskunder enligt SKI 2017. Smarta tjänster för ditt företag.
Thank you for downloading the Start the Week podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello. During this general election campaign, we will be talking, I'm sure, about Britain and the EU, trade deals, employment, productivity, frankly, all the usual stuff. But it's unlikely that this campaign will really touch on the deepest challenges to our accelerating industrial global civilization. This week, we've gathered together three very different but radical environmental voices. The Kentucky farmer Wendell Berry has for decades been a passionate critic of the modern industrial age and has aimed his essays, poems, stories and novels against all those who sneer at old-fashioned, local, earthbound ways of living. As a political writer, he is right up there with George Orwell. Kate Raworth, meanwhile, in her new book, Donut Economics, asks difficult, pointed questions about the limits of growth and the outdated models used by almost all conventional economists. And that's got her compared by some admirers to John Maynard Keynes. The novelist and poet Paul Kingsnorth, meanwhile, who has edited Wendell Berry for a British audience, is now turning his back on much of conventional green or environmental politics, which he thinks has sold out both to big business and to the socialist left. So lots to chew over. Let me start with you, if I may, Wendell Berry. Can you just describe where you are and what is around you?
Well, I'm upstairs in my house, on the westward, more or less, valley side of the Kentucky River. And I'm looking out at the hillside pasture.
And you're surrounded by land that you farm, but you don't farm it with modern industrial equipment, do you?
Well, I have a very marginal, steep farm. And, well, I'd use some industrial equipment for when I'm using my horses. But it's outdated industrial equipment. But I don't hesitate when I need to do so to ask somebody to come and help me with a tractor. Now that I'm old, that's more frequent.
When you were young, you went to the city as a young, you wanted to be a writer. You went to the big city, but you didn't feel that you were at home. And you had a kind of very important revelation, really, which returned you to the land that your own family had been farming for generations. Just describe what happened, if you would, for us.
Sometimes my wife, Tanya, and I are given too much credit for that move, as if we foresaw what would happen, or that we had some exalted notion of what was right. We did what we wanted to. Until then, I'd assumed I would be a sort of academic wanderer, going wherever I could get work as a teacher. And then I got invited to come back to Kentucky and teach at the University of Kentucky, and bought this old place here near the town of Port Royal, which is my ancestral town. And we thought we would use it as a weekend place, and we started fixing it up and realized that this was where we're going to live. And so we've been living here ever since 1965.
And you've written, I don't know how many, but very many books of essays complaining about what has happened to American landscape and agriculture through industrialization, and what has happened to the communities that used to be rooted to living in those areas. Can you talk a little bit about what horrifies you most about the American industrial system at the moment?
Well, it's, I haven't written merely a complaint. I've tried to write a kind of criticism of land use, which eventually becomes a criticism of the of the industrial system and industrial values. What horrified me most was that I realized that when I began to live here, that everything of value in this place is at stake and at risk, and that it was considered by most people as a kind of raw material that ought to be subjected to what they now call creative destruction for the sake, typically, of a better life in the future or a better life for our children.
Can we start by talking a little bit about topsoil? You write a lot about topsoil. Why is that such an important modern issue, do you think?
Well, the topsoil is what we live from. It's what everything alive lives from, all the organisms. And the topsoil is the great resource that supports our life. And there's only a limited amount of it. There are few places in the world where it's very deep. Most places are like my home country here. The topsoil is fairly shallow, and it needs to be covered mostly with perennial plants. And when it's uncovered and exposed to the weather, it is extremely vulnerable to erosion.
And across the West, we've lost a huge proportion of our topsoil over the last 50 years or so.
Yes. Yes, we've treated the loss of soil and the contamination of it by chemicals as if those detractions were a normal and allowable and sustainable cost of industrial production. But there's a comparable drawdown in the cultures of husbandry that need to be in place everywhere, and they've been destroyed everywhere as of no value.
I described you as an essayist, and for many people that's how you're best known, but you're also, of course, a writer of short stories and fictions and of poems. And I wonder if you'd read for us, just so people can get a sense of how you write, one of your Sabbath's poems, Sabbath 1989, or the beginning of that poem, Forrest
yes,
Wendell.
I'll read the poem that you asked me to read. In early morning we awaken from the sound of engines running in the night, and then we start the engines of the day. We speed away into the fading light. Nowhere is any sound but of our going, on roads strung everywhere with humming wire. Nowhere is there an end except in smoke. This is the world that we have set on fire. This is the promised burning, darkening our light and hope, and putting out the sun, blighting the leaf, the stream, and blessed are the dead who died before this time began. Blessed the dead who have escaped in time, the twisted metal and the fractured stone, the techno bodies of the hopeless cure. Now to the living only grief has shone, the little yellow of the violet, risen again out of the dead year's leaves. And grief alone is the measure of the love that only lives by rising out of graves. I have to say, that's pretty well scraping the bottom of my soul. I don't know that I've ever written anything so gloomy again.
Well, I was going to ask you.
You could say that my whole life's work has been opposed to that kind of gloom.
And you've written a lot about the importance of conviviality and sensual enjoyment and community in your writing as well. Very important, I think, for a lot of people who are on the green side of the argument, if you like. The world can seem unbearably depressing at the moment, as if there is nothing that can be done except to rend your clothes and cry.
Yes. Well, conviviality means living together. And if you begin to subtract from the things that are to be counted as living together, then you begin to invite the ruin that we have. So we have to consider a community as the commonwealth of all the life that place contains. The so-called natural creatures, the domestic creatures, the humans.
And so we get away from what Kate Raworth would describe as economic man or homo economicus, this individual, self-interested creature standing aside and outside nature. That is the root of a lot of our trouble, I think, as far as you're concerned.
Yes, that's the root of it as far as I'm concerned. That we are living from nature in an economy that doesn't value nature whatsoever. The conventional economists can talk long about the supposed science of economics without ever mentioning either the natural world as it has come to us, or the land-using economies that make the natural goods available for human use. We're not talking, economists are not talking about forestry and the difference between good and bad forestry, or about farming and the difference between good and bad farming, or even mining and the difference between, there's no such thing as good mining, I suppose, but the difference between better and worst mining. All those things are considerable, and they're not being considered.
You have written against the industrial economy in many essays, but you've also been quite sceptical about, as it were, traditional political protest movements. Why is that?
Well, I've been reading Paul Kingsnorth, which is only fair in view of his kindness to me. And I can answer that by reading some sentences that he wrote. And this is Paul Kingsnorth talking here. Traditional leftist activism entrenches a kind of dependency. It involves identifying an enemy and then taking it on. There is always a them who needs to sort out the problem. And that gives us, the disempowered but righteous masses, more of an excuse to wash our hands of our own complicity, or simply to never get them dirty in the first place. It's easy to encounter people in the present world who do nothing much but protest. And I think that the great question that conservation has to face is, how do you get from protest, which is always asking somebody else to do something better, to actual work in circumstances, in the real circumstances of our lives, that ask us to do something better? That is, how do you get from protest to good work?
To doing good work, exactly.
And he then follows a little later with a sentence that I really like. When you take responsibility for a specific something, it's possible you might get somewhere. And it's that specific something that I have my mind on and that I think is going to be the measure of our work.
So your protest...
The health of that specific something.
So your specific protest, if you like, has been decades of how you live and work on the land as well as what you write.
Living well is something that none of us is doing in a complete or perfect way. We're all complicit in the things that we oppose. And that's where it gets interesting. None of us are going to die free of sin. I think we're in original sin round two. We're all involved in the destruction of the goods of the world.
Well, I'm going to bring in Paul Kingsnorth now, who's been sitting here listening to this, because Paul Kingsnorth too has decided that the way he lives is crucial to his response to what's happening at the moment. So before we get to that, Paul, we need to start with where you began as a student involved in road protests. Why was that so important? What did that do to you? I suppose before that, we have to start with you going on long walks with your father, which is where you develop a deep love of the natural world.
Well, I suppose, like many other people, I spent enough time in the natural world as a child to fall in love with it, which, by the way, I think is at the root of all environmentalism. We don't like the word love. It's a bit unscientific, but it's actually the basis of any of this. It's about connection. It's about love and attachment. Enough time spent on mountains and moors and enough time spent in as wild a place as you can get in Britain sparked in me a sense that there was something precious about that, that I felt very connected to. And then when I was a student, being young and radical as students will, it was the time of the road protest movement in the mid-90s. A lot of direct action to literally try to prevent putting yourself in the way of bulldozers to prevent
And these
roads
are very special places like
places.
Twyford Down.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's very interesting because this is how it starts. You hear that there's a beautiful hillside with an ancient wood and a historic monument on it, and they're going to bulldoze it, and you're 19, and you want to put yourself in the way of that and stop it happening, which is great, by the way. And while we're being critical of protest, that's the kind of protest which is always good, as far as I'm concerned. But then, you do that, and then you ask, well, why is this road being built? And then you start thinking about traffic volumes, and then you start discovering the routes of container lorries, and then you trace it all back, and you trace it up to the global level, and you realise it's all about the industrial economy and economic growth, and suddenly you're in kind of quite deep in an analysis of how we've got to the point that we can destroy places which are clearly precious and important to people in the name of, for example, in the case of Twyford Down, saving 12 minutes on a road journey from London to Southampton. What kind of a deal is that? And it doesn't seem like a very good one. So that's kind of where the journey starts, I suppose.
But now we have a very big and vigorous environmental or green movement, and you are critical of that. Now, Wendell Berry gave us some hint about why you're critical of the left in that regard. But let's talk a little bit of what you think has gone wrong with the green movement generally.
Yeah, sure. But before I do that, I want to avoid taking too many divisive positions. I want to say that, environmentalism is still a valuable thing, and the great majority of people involved in it are doing valuable work. So I don't want to sit here being attacking, people who are kind of putting themselves on the line. But what I discovered or believed in my journey through environmentalism really was that we had kind of stopped seeing the forest for the trees, I think. In one of the essays I've written for my book, I tried to describe that personal journey. And I talked about going to a place like Twyford Down and being involved in trying to prevent a motorway being built through it. And then I talked about looking around at where I was now and seeing industrial wind farms appearing on the mountains and barrages appearing on wild rivers and wave machines and turbines appearing in the wild oceans. And I looked at this and I thought, well, we're still industrializing the wild places. And sure, we're doing it in the name of producing less carbon than we previously would have been, but we're still doing that within the context of a giant industrial growth machine. So we're effectively simply sacrificing wild places to the machine, and we find ourselves in a position where environmentalists, often for the best of reasons, end up pushing something they call sustainability, which in practice actually ends up being sustaining middle-class consumer lifestyles in the West, rather than making the kind of sacrifices that Wendell was talking about, which we would all have to make and which we find it very hard to make, which would actually genuinely create something different. We're locked into a growth machine, personally, and in terms of the politics that we pursue, so much so that the Green Movement, with all its good intentions, has become, I think, part of that machine. I don't blame anybody for that. I think it's almost an inevitable part of working within this industrial growth economy and trying to slow it down when it actually can't be slowed.
That's what you mean when you say the Green Movement's torpedoed itself with numbers and become obsessed by carbon emissions at the expense of everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think the related problem, I think, is that we've all tried to behave like grown-ups, So we've all started pretending that we're economists and scientists and we wear suits and we walk around talking about GDP and all this kind of stuff. And we're not really grown-ups, actually. We're, in the best sense of the word, we're people who are trying to bring a different... I think environmentalists are trying to bring a different consideration to the debate. We are actually talking about love, and we are talking about the intrinsic meaning of places and the intrinsic value of nature, but we don't do that. We talk in the kind of numbers and the kind of figures that society wants us to talk in, and that's a trap.
There's such a lot to talk about there, but before we do, I want to take the story up to date, as it were, because you then decide, a bit like Wendell Berry in a sense, you pull yourself back to the land and decide, if I'm going to make a change, I have to do it myself. Just tell us a little bit about how you've made that change. We can talk about toilets, if you like.
Everybody wants to talk about the toilet. Yes. Well, look, I mean, I suppose I just got to the stage where I thought, I can't keep writing and talking about nature if I'm sitting in the middle of a city in front of a keyboard all day, and I don't have very much contact with it. It doesn't seem to be very good for my soul, and I don't think it's informing my work very well. And so what I managed to do with my family was to we moved to the west of Ireland, and we bought a couple of acres of land. We were lucky enough to be in a position to do that, which not everybody is. And yeah, we're trying to live in a small scale way as we can. And that's not a kind of Puritan one-upmanship at all. In some ways, it's in search of what Wendell's talking about when he talks about conviviality. As much as anything, it's about joy and the pleasure of doing it, the pleasure of waking up in the morning to birdsong and seeing the stars at night. So yes, we replaced our flush loo with a compost toilet, and we grow our own vegetables, and we plant our own fuel trees and all that kind of thing. But it to me, just the small rhythms of being in a small place and getting to know it are at the root of what we're talking about. And I think that environmentalism generally, because of the society we're living in, has become, like the rest of society, deeply urban, very much entwined with the industrial machine. And once we get too far down that path, I don't know whether we can actually have a connection with the natural world that we're trying to protect.
And if there's one word that's thrown at you that really gets your goat, I don't know if you've got a goat, but would get your goat if you had one, it's romanticism. You're a romantic.
Well, I've tried to reclaim that word, actually. I think this is what we need to do. Yeah, I mean, I'm constantly being accused, as are people like Wendell, of being a romantic and a Luddite and a reactionary and a throwback and all the rest of it. And that's based on this assumption that as we move forward in history, we're inevitably moving to a kind of techno-industrial utopia. And in the past, there's this kind of dreadful rural mess that we have to move away from. I don't think that's the way it works. I think what I'm trying to do, and what a lot of other people are trying to do as well and would like to do, it's just to reconnect with the soil under our feet and the rest of the natural world that we're still a part of. If we can't do that in our lives, and if we can't give that to our children, if we can't have some connection with reality outside this kind of smartphone bubble that we're building, then I just think we're lost. I just think we're lost, and I couldn't move on in my life without trying to do that in any way that I could do.
So what is your advice to those people who can't afford or have the means? Not everybody can go to a small holding in Ireland or anywhere else. There simply isn't enough land. A lot of people depend upon industrialised agriculture to feed themselves at the moment. What is your advice to people listening to that who might say, yes, intuitively, instinctively, I think something is fundamentally wrong with our economic system. I would like to start making the change for myself. What do you start doing?
Yeah, well, it's very hard, isn't it? I'm not trying to set an example. I'm just kind of doing what I could do, luckily, and because I chose to do it. But I just think we can all do what we can do. I think that we can read as much as we can about this. We can think about it. We can talk about these challenges that we've been talking about today in a way that, as you said at the beginning, just does not appear in the political discussion, doesn't appear in the cultural discussion. We can do whatever we can to get our hands dirty and protect the natural world, whether it's from a window box to a garden to a piece of land. There's always something we can do. It's my view that we are in the middle of a ecological catastrophe on a global scale, and the most valuable thing anybody can do in however small a way is try to protect as much of the natural world as they can. And it doesn't have to be having a farm or holding a nature reserve. It could be as small as you can manage.
Wendell Berry, would you agree with that?
Yes, I'd like to bring this matter home. I'm grateful to Paul for bringing the word love into this, and to me I think that's been dismissed as an emotion, but actually it's a motive. You take care of the things you love. And there's a real possibility that I consider all the time that if you don't love something, you can't even know it. So this hillside that I'm looking at, I love. I've taken very good care of it. I've done a lot of work there. I've taken a lot of pleasure from it. But on that hillside, not far from my house, there are three large solar collectors. And as my wife was the first to say, and as I agree, they're ugly. They insult that hillside. They ought to be there. They've done me a lot of good. Anytime anybody accuses me of being a Luddite, I can say, where are your solar collectors? But that the fact that they're ugly, that they don't add anything of real substance to our relationship to this place, is a consideration.
Mm.
And I know that there are people who, in the interest of this abstraction sustainability, would cover the whole hillside with solar panels. And I wouldn't accept that as a solution. I would begin to protest all over again.
Well, coming back to this great conflict between the big abstract words and life as it's lived, and Kate Raworth, in your Donut Economics, you spend a lot of time very effectively demolishing some of the original graphs and presuppositions that underline conventional economics. Just tell us a little bit about where you start in that demolition job.
Well, I started when I studied economics at university 25 years ago and was deeply frustrated and disillusioned with what I learned, because most of the things I cared about, like social justice and the environment, were brushed aside, pushed to the fringes of the theory. So I walked away from economics, too embarrassed to call myself an economist, because who would want to be that? And yet I found myself coming back to it 25 years later, because you can't walk away from economics. It's the language of public policy. It's the language that frames how elections are fought. And if we want to change the world, we need to change economics. Today, economics is taught as if it's about a series of equations. And I think actually that deadens it into some sort of obscure form of math. It strips the politics out. It strips the issues out. Actually, I think the power of economics lies in its diagrams. Any neuroscientist will tell you that half of the nerve fibers in our brains are connected to our vision. And in every economics textbook, alongside the text and the equations, are diagrams, treated often as if they're little illustrations. Actually, I think they frame the way we understand the world.
And there is no diagram probably more powerful than the price and distribution diagram, but also the diagram which shows constant growth. The object of all economics is endless growth, and yet if there's one thing we understand from the natural world, is that nothing grows forever.
Right. Economics lost sight of having a goal. When Adam Smith first defined what the object of economics should be, he defined it around a goal. It should be that the economy enables each person to meet their needs and their subsistence and to raise enough money to provide for public goods. But over the years, over the last 200 years, economists wanted to make economics a science as reputable as physics. And so they stripped out the goal. Well, in its place sneaked a cuckoo goal of GDP growth. And we now have economies that are addicted financially, socially, and politically to unending GDP growth. Let's look at everything in nature, because 3.8 billion years of experimentation by nature is a wonderful thing to learn from. Nothing in nature grows forever. From your children's feet to the Amazon forest, growth is a wonderful, healthy phase. But then things mature and thrive and can thrive for eons. When something tries to grow forever inside our bodies, we call that cancer. So we know in our bodies that actually balance is the place where we thrive. I find it extraordinary in the subject of economics, and I studied it for 4 years, not once did the question come up, can an economy grow forever? Why? How can it grow forever? What would happen if it couldn't grow forever? Could we ever create an economy that allowed us to thrive without growing? These questions aren't even asked. It shows that we're trapped in a growth mentality that we need to overthrow.
And of course, the word itself, as you point out in the book, comes from household management, I think, of both Wendell Berry and Paul Kingsnorth, and that's it starts with the household.
Well, this is the deep irony. Economics comes from ecos, the household, and nomos, the management of. It has the same roots as ecology, the knowledge of the household. The sheer arrogance of economics is that we want to manage the household without even understanding it. So you can study economics and never learn about the planetary systems that we depend upon. You can go straight in and learn about finance and inflation and interest rates. The natural world, where does it come in? It's called an externality. I'm sorry, if you're going to call the natural world an externality, you've already told me how unimportant it is.
Got a long way from the language of love at that point. And your crucial diagram is a donut. You call your book Donut Economics. Just explain to us what the donut is and how it works.
Yeah, the donut, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I think it's time to get playful as a form of protest and put new ideas at the heart of economic thinking. So the donut is the kind with a hole in the middle. And when I sat down to draw a picture of what progress in the 21st century could look like, it came out ridiculous, though it sounds looking like a donut. So in that hole in the middle is a place of poverty. It's a place where people are falling short on life's essentials, be it food, decent housing, healthcare, education. And we want to get everybody out of that hole and into the donut itself. But
beyond the donut.
Beyond the donut, we must not go beyond its outer crust, because that's a place where we're overshooting our pressure on the living systems on which we depend. We are kicking ourselves out of a stable climate, kicking ourselves out of having fertile soils, healthy oceans, protective ozone layer, all of these things that fundamentally underpin our well-being. Economists in the 20th century didn't have to confront that because we didn't yet realise the extraordinary scale of pressure that we're putting on the planet. So the 21st century economist has a new challenge. How do we get everybody out of that space of deprivation while remaining within the planet's life-giving systems? And this calls for a completely new economics.
Now, we're in the middle of an election campaign already, Kate Rowe, and you raise the question in this book, what happens when growth stops, when conventional economic growth can't be sustained and that great upward line starts to wilt? And you suggest that there then has to be a completely different rethinking of democratic politics, and it's going to look very different. And I'm just wondering if that crash landing, if you like, has happened already. If you look at median incomes in America, across much of Europe and the UK as well, lots and lots of people have seen no real prosperity growth over the last 20 years or so, which is why they're so angry and we're getting a different kind of politics.
And this is one of the fascinating things, because until, say, before the financial crisis in 2008, anybody who talked about the possible limits to growth was seen as an environmental radical. And it was always only asked as an environmental question, is growth actually no longer possible? What's happened since then is that the mainstream economists who are forecasting what they call flat growth for the future, from the International Monetary Fund to in the world's richest countries, they're forecasting very little, no or low growth. Now the question is not just is growth maybe not possible, but perhaps it's just not coming. But if growth isn't coming, then we've ended up in an economy we don't want. I mean, this is not an economy we want to thrive in at all. We have a deeply divisive economy where the 1% reap the vast majority of gains from the economy. And we have a deeply degenerative one. We are devouring the sources of the living world on which we depend. We urgently need to transform our economy. So rather than focusing on is growth coming or not, I want to put new principles at the heart of economics. We need to create a distributive economy where the value created is shared far more equitably amongst all those who create it. And we need to create a regenerative economy where we work with the processes of the living world rather than against them.
Paul Kingsnorth, I'm going to read back to you something you wrote in your book when you attack something called neo-environmentalism. And you say it's an old-fashioned big science, big tech and big money narrative filtered through the lens of the internet and garlanded with holier-than-thou talk about saving the poor and feeding the world. And I just wonder if that sounds a little bit like what Kate's been talking about.
Well, I hope not. That would be a bit harsh. It's interesting. I mean, what I'm talking about there is a certain type of environmentalism which effectively says we don't need to worry because technology can save us. Much more common now. It's increasingly common the worse things get. So we hear we don't need to change our lives. We don't need to question our underlying
technical
values. It'll be fine. Technology will solve climate change. Technology will solve X, Y, and Z. And that's just a religious faith. It doesn't have, I mean, technology can be useful, but that's not the issue. I suppose the question I would have for Kate is how can this possibly be applied on a global scale? And secondly, do we want to apply it on a global scale? Because I have a suspicion of big ideas. And when I hear us talking like this, what I hear is potentially the potential for another kind of globe-spanning idea which actually takes our sort of Western liberal values and puts them onto every community on Earth. So we're talking about what we would like growth to be, and we have a lot of hidden assumptions about what we think development is and what we think wealth is and what a good life is. And while those are useful measurements, aren't they still stuck in the trap that economics tends to take us into, which is imagining that we can measure everything by the same metrics and we can create a global scheme, a global plan? And how could it be rolled out without, say, I don't know, a global governance or...
Well, I think the best way to overthrow a story that you believe is destructive is to propose a new story. And I have tried in proposing this story, which is about a story of meeting the needs of all within the means of the planet, to be global, precisely because I think that now is the era in which we need to be global. Economics came from ancient Greece. It was a phrase created by Xenophon, who was talking about the management of a single household. How should you let your wife manage the household? Should you trust your slaves? Adam Smith turned it into the management of a nation state. And I think our era, more than 250 years on, our job is to turn it into planetary household management, because unless we actually look at the planetary scale, we haven't got a chance of protecting this shared living world on which we depend. Of course we have different needs. Decent housing, or what an education looks like, is going to differ from place to place. But what excites me is, rather than churning up a global top-down plan, what I'm finding is this donut diagram I've drawn is being picked up by local districts who are turning it into their own. So there's some urban designers in Stockholm in Sweden who are saying, we're developing a new district of Sweden and we're designing it on the basis of your donut. We want to figure out how we can develop a district of Stockholm that meets the needs of all its inhabitants within the means of the planet. On the other side of the world, I've been contacted by town planners in South Africa, the fastest growing town in KwaZulu-Natal called Kokstad. They said, we took this donut diagram and we made it our own. We work with the youth of the town and we added in fun, because we think it's really important to have fun while we transform the economy. And we're devising a new vision for our town based around this idea. How do we meet the needs of all within the means of the planet? So it's about taking an idea and making it relevant to a place. And it excites me when people start doing that and making it their own.
By the way, for people listening, I have deliberately not brought in, as it were, a traditional growth economist, because I didn't want to get into a Punch and Judy show about this. We want to examine the idea properly. And in that spirit, Kate, if a government picked up your model, give me some examples of actual hard-edged policies that you think would then follow from that.
Well, if a government picked up this book and said, right, we are going to transform our idea of the economy, we're going to stop pursuing growth for growth's sake because we're addicted to it, we're actually going to create an economy that is regenerative by design, it's working with Earth's living processes, and it's distributive so that it's sharing value more widely, that government would switch from taxing employment to taxing resource use and pollution. Instantly, you know, taxing the things that we want to limit, not taxing something that's valuable. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
So slash payroll taxes and tax water and soil instead.
Absolutely. That government would stop financing fossil fuels, stop subsidising fossil fuels, and definitely stop taking money from fossil fuel companies, because that is something we have to leave in the past for sure. That government would encourage companies and great company law, so that companies were founded with a purpose greater than merely maximising shareholder returns. That is such a narrow vision of what an enterprise is for.
Paul is looking a little twitchy here. I can't see if Wendell Berry is looking twitchy because he's in Kentucky. But let me start with you, Wendell. How do you react to that?
I like when she speaks of the application of more or less universal idea to a place. That makes sense to me. There has to be a conversation between the general and the particular. That's the way we understand each other across boundaries. But the acceptance of the boundaries, to me, is critical. And it seems to me that limit or limits is another word that we can't do without. In order to do anything, we have to accept limits. It's the essence of any art, which I take to be simply a way of making or doing. You can't do that without accepting a limit, any more than you can sit down and stand up at the same time. You have to, in order to do something, you have to accept a limit of your own capacity and the limit of the local place.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to bring this home to me, because we've been talking a lot about what could happen at a local scale, and the question of scale seems to be so important to me. I mean, I always seem to come back around to this in everything I write. And, you know, we've talked about what governments can do and what sort of ideas we should have globally, and that's important, and that conversation between the local general and the particular, as Wendell puts it, is important too. But we still are stuck in the assumption that what we need to do is get governments to do things, that what we need to do is have a big notion that we can roll out globally. And while that can be useful, again, if we're talking about turning around ideas, what if we turn around the idea and start locally? And we say, well, how can we create a society in which actually governments and corporations and the giant institutions which have actually created this giant growth monster get out of the way or are reined in or limited, at least to as much a degree as is realistic, and give the local a chance to flourish, give the home a chance to flourish? Because what we're doing at the moment is we've created a system in which everything's small and local, in particular the home and us as individuals, we're just fuel for this machine. We're just being harvested almost by the growth machine. And we certainly need to have new ways of looking at economics, and that's vital. But I also think maybe we need to have new ways of looking at that relationship. Instead of assuming the government has to do something or we have to have a new idea, how about thinking about how we can get that out of the way, almost off people's shoulders, so that the home can start to work again and the local can start to work again?
We started earlier on in this conversation by talking about how environmentalism, or how one describes it, begins with a kind of enthusiasm and a zest for wild nature in particular, and the world in which we are embedded, that nature is something we are part of, not something that we stand atop or exploit, as Kate Raworth has said. And in that spirit, Wendell Berry, we heard your gloomier poem earlier on, but I wonder, spring is upon us now. If you could just describe for us a little bit about what is going on the Kentucky hillside you love so much around you.
Well, at the moment I have 8 ewes up there on that hillside. One old ewe who lost her lambs, and a ewe that didn't breed, and then I have 6 pretty good yearling ewes that will be bred this fall. And the rest of what's going on is that the birds are going about their business, and the hillside is growing grass, which is its business. Growing plants, there's some trees up there too.
So thanks to all my guests, Wendell Berry's The World Ending Fire, Paul Kingsnorth's Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, and Kate Raworth's Donut Economics are all out now. Next week, we're looking for the epic in everyday life with Kate Tempest, Hanif Qureshi and Tracy Chevalier. But for now, thank you and goodbye.
There's more information about Start the Week on the programme's website. Go to bbc.co.uk, where you'll also find many more Radio 4 programmes you can download for free.
Nu är gräset ännu grönare. Teckna företagsabonnemang hos Telia och få en Galaxy S9 på köpet. Eller en av våra andra utvalda modeller. Läs mer på telia.se/företag. Fler anledningar? Bäst mobilnät enligt P3s mätning. Sveriges nöjdaste företagskunder enligt SKI 2017. Smarta tjänster för ditt företag.